Hi, friends, and welcome back to the Meditative Aiden podcast, where we talk about mindfulness and how mindfulness can help you work through and overcome the challenges and experiences of everyday life. My name is Aiden, and this is episode number 8 on where mindfulness comes from. In this episode, we're going to kind of investigate, some of the historical roots of mindfulness, really answering the question where mindfulness originated. To answer this question, to figure out where it comes from and what this means, we're going to go through tracing some roots in ancient Buddhism. We're going to talk about how the Buddha taught mindfulness to his students at the time. Then we're going to talk about an Indian mythology that helps add a little bit of context to this. So without further ado, let's get to it. So as I began my journey on mindfulness, I started, learning the definition and the practices and, the benefits of mindfulness, how it could help me and so on and so forth. But as I started getting further and further into it, I wanted to know more about, the history. Where did it originate from? Where does it come from? Does it come from Africa? Does it come from China? Where? And in my studies over time, I found that the word mindfulness actually comes from the Buddhist tradition, and it's most widely used in the Buddhist tradition, more so than any other religion or philosophy, if any other religion or philosophy even uses that word at all. I had to go back and explore the time of the Buddha, because apparently the Buddha used this word a lot when he was teaching his students. This takes us back almost 2,500 years to about 500 BC or 300 BC, right around that era. And the thing about the Buddha is that he never actually recorded any of his sayings or his teachings and didn't have any of his students do the same either. So what happens is we have this big gap between when the Buddha was alive and when his teachings were actually recorded. The first recorded Buddhist texts, the first recorded Buddhist traditions seem to come out right around, 300 years after the Buddha died, which means that for 300 years, everything the Buddha had taught and all of the things that his students were learning were just, it was just an oral tradition. It was being passed from ear to ear and from generation to generation. So eventually, when all of these texts came together, when things were starting to get recorded, it came together in what's known as the Pali Canon, which is like a 3,600-page book filled with the dissertations and the different teachings of the Buddha. And this Pali Canon was written in the language of the day, which was Pali. And throughout the text, we find this word sati, which scholars have interpreted to mean mindfulness. I thought this was pretty cool at first. I thought that I had found the roots. But the thing is that scholars have translated this word, and so some meaning has been lost in that translation. We find this a lot even when just translating from one language to another nowadays between Spanish and English or German and English and so on. What the actual word means, if you go into the roots and really try to figure out the definition, sati means to remember or to recollect, which kind of differs a lot from the modern definition of mindfulness. Because mindfulness, concisely defined, is, an awareness of the present moment, an accepting, non-judgmental awareness of the present moment, which seems to contrast with this ancient word sati, which means just to remember. So the question that then arises is, how did modern scholars get our definition of mindfulness from this simple word that the Buddha used? And the answer lies in understanding the context of the Buddha's teachings at the time. So when the Buddha taught, he would tell his students to remember his teachings. He would tell them that as they were meditating and they became distracted by thoughts or sensations, that they were to take that experience and mentally note it and remember that experience, but to remember to bring the attention away from that distraction and back into the awareness of the present moment. In remembering the experience and that distraction that occurs, it reminds them of what distraction feels like. As they became more aware of their distractions, they were better able to understand the situations that occurred without, their conscious effort, and how to consciously bring their attention away from that back into the experience. one of the first values I've got out of this is that when those distractions occur, we can't just forget them. We have to remember what it's like to be distracted, because so often as we're going through day-to-day life, we get distracted and we're unaware of that distraction. It just happens without us knowing. So often when I meditate, I find that, you know, I'll be lost in a distraction and won't even be aware that I'm lost in it. I'm just kind of in that moment. So what the Buddha says is when that distraction occurs, bring that awareness away from the distraction back into the grounding of the present moment. So fundamentally, what sati means in the original context of Buddhism is that when you are distracted, remember the teachings of the Buddha and what the Buddha has taught to come back to the present moment and the richness of the experience of this moment. I'd like to touch on one of the major teachings of the Buddha as well, to kind of remember what it is that teaching is that we're supposed to remember that helps bring us back to the present, kind of the motivating force for doing so. And it's no secret that in Buddhism, there's the massive philosophy that life is suffering, and clinging to thoughts and experiences is what causes that suffering. This is one of the Four Noble Truths. In fact, I think it's the first two of Buddhism, is that life is suffering and then clinging causes suffering. The reason that this is important to understand here is because the Buddha taught that when you cling to an experience such as happiness, you always are living in this moment of chasing that, and you're never satisfied in that chase until you've gotten that happiness. Similarly, when you get that happiness, you're just looking for the next opportunity to be happy as opposed to staying in the present. And this constant struggle for happiness in this example leads you to a persistent state of upset and disappointment. It's also kind of like when you think of an experience, a really good memory that you have, there's nothing wrong with thinking of that experience, but if you constantly long for that experience to come back with a sense of nostalgia that's unhealthy, you're brooding in yourself. You're building this sense of constant unhappiness because things aren't the way that they used to be. So often I hear people say, you know, back in the golden days. And the thing is that the golden days are here in the present moment, here and now. Because when you brood over the way that things were and the fact that they're no longer like that, when you cling to the past, you build in yourself this state of constant psychological disappointment. You're building a situation that is going to fail. I mean, clinging to these things just sets you up for failure. In a more practical, real-world example, I like to refer to New Year's resolutions because it's become something that's widely talked about in the self-help community and, you know, just in psychology in general. And the reason is because at the start of the new year, we set these grand goals and these grand resolutions about what we're going to do and how we're going to change. And then we set this expectation that we're going to do that. We expect ourselves to meet this demand that we've set for ourselves. And the issue is that when we don't meet that expectation, we beat ourselves up for it, for not being good enough, for not being able to measure up, for never following through. And like I said, this just creates a situation where you're building a situation that's going to fail. You're building a trap for yourself where you're going to trap yourself in this psychology of negativity, of never being good enough. And I can only say how many times I've done this, how many resolutions and goals I've set that I didn't measure up to, that I didn't meet, and that then I beat myself up for. And I know that you're similar because all of us have done this. I mean, we've all attached and clung to this expectation to perform, especially in a performance-oriented society as the Western world. But the thing is that the Buddha wasn't saying that you need to stop setting goals, you need to stop dreaming. I mean, otherwise, what would be the point of trying to develop a mindfulness practice without having some kind of dream of, you know, being free from anxiety, being free of depression, or being able to develop the tools to work through those experiences? What the Buddha is saying is that when we set expectations upon reality, we set ourselves up for failure. So instead of saying that this experience, this goal should happen, what we tell ourselves instead is that this could happen. And that's what mindfulness is about, is being accepting of the present moment, of accepting what happens. So when you set that goal, you still have that ambition to work towards it. But instead of clinging to your goal and identifying with it, instead of allowing yourself to become attached to the accomplishment of the goal, you allow yourself to be present with the goal as it progresses. What this means is that instead of saying this goal should happen, like I said before, you find acceptance through mindfulness of allowing that goal to happen, what could happen with it. And this is the teaching that the Buddha was encouraging his students to remember, that when these distractions occur, when you find your mind wandering with sensations or thoughts, instead of beating yourself up and instead of identifying with that or clinging to it or attaching to it or deriving some sort of identity from it, you instead allow yourself to remember that teaching, to remember to not identify with it, and bring that awareness back into the present moment. The thing is that the word sati alone doesn't embrace that entire concept. I mean, it kind of refers to the teachings of the Buddha and refers to remembering in general. And the modern definition of mindfulness, the way that it's been translated by scholars, kind of encompasses that entire definition, that entire context, saying that you remember the teachings and you remember to bring your awareness into the present moment with open acceptance and presence. And that's how we bridge the gap between what sati means in the ancient context and what mindfulness means now. Now, I do want to bring up at this point something interesting that I found as I was doing my study. You know, I just did a simple Google search at one point for the word sati. And the first thing that Google showed, the first definition it brought up, was an ancient Indian tradition that is now banned in India of a widow throwing herself on her husband's funeral pyre to kill herself. And my first response to this was, what? Because I had been studying mindfulness for a while. I'd been studying the context and the history and, you know, to hear about, on the one hand, it means to remember, but then Google is deriving some definition that means to throw yourself on your husband's funeral pyre. What am I missing? There's some bridge that needs to be gapped here. So I decided to do a little digging to figure out what the heck I was missing. And this part may be for some of you history geeks and stuff like that. I'm a history geek, and I really wanted to know how on earth this was related. So after some study, I found out about this Indian mythology, which involves Shiva and Sati Privarti. And I don't know if I'm saying Sati Privarti's name right. I probably butchered it, but you know, I gave it my best shot. Now, Shiva is one of the major gods in Hinduism, like one of the top three or four. And Sati Privarti is his wife. In their love story, what happens is Sati starts out I'm not sure if she's a god or just a human or something like that. Nonetheless, she falls in love with Shiva, and eventually they get married against her father's wishes. And what happens is her father has some kind of ritual sacrifice happening. And at the time, ritual sacrifice was really important for, you know, paying respect to the gods, and also as a method of remembering the sacred text, remembering the sacred things in life. There's a lot more that we can go into, a lot more depth we can go into. But fundamentally, to not be invited to one of these rituals was kind of rude, because it was such a big thing for everyone spiritually. And Sati's father, while staging this ritual, intentionally didn't invite Shiva. And Sati was so overwhelmed with grief about this, because it was such a big ordeal. I mean, everyone in town was going, that she killed herself. She died. And when Shiva found out about this, he didn't go take vengeance and kill her father. He grabbed Sati's body and held it on his shoulder as he walked around the globe mourning. And this is where the story gets a little weird, because as he's walking around the globe, he's just soaked with sadness. I love that phrase, soaked with sadness. Anyway, he's walking around the globe with just this profound sense of loss, because this was his wife, whom he loved. And eventually, all of the other gods notice how much he's suffering. And like I said, this gets weird. They dismember her body and scatter her body parts throughout the world so that he can stop grieving. Now, whatever purpose that has to play in the story, I'm not sure. But after that, Sati is reincarnated as a god, the god Parvati, and remains as Shiva's loyal husband. And to this day, in Hindu mythology and Hindu culture, Shiva's wife is Parvati and has remained so for the duration of time. One of the major elements of this story is the amount of love that Sati has for Shiva. So much that when Shiva's not invited to this ritual, to this grand event, she kills herself because she's so in love with him, so devoted to him, that the only thing she can think of doing is sacrificing her life. Now, I don't know about you, but if that ever happened and like my wife wasn't invited to a party, but I was, I just wouldn't go to the party. I wouldn't kill myself. But nonetheless, what happens is around the time that this mythology, this ancient story started circulating around India, women started throwing themselves on their husband's funeral pyres who had passed before them. And the reason for this, I believe from what I studied, is that it was a symbolic representation, a reenactment of them showing their love for their husband and their devotion to their husband, just like Sati had. Now, as far as I can tell, the sources are very vague and it's hard to find a clear answer. But from what I can tell, using the word Sati in that context means to remember the sacrifice of Sati, to remember the devotion of Sati. And I believe that's where the Buddha derived this word from. You know, I may not be entirely correct, but it seems like the most logical interpretation from the sources I was able to read and gather information from. And the purpose of telling you that story is so that if you go and search up the word Sati, you're not suddenly taken aback like I've been giving you the wrong definition, but to kind of give a little more background to the actual word and where it comes from. And that goes a little bit further back than maybe we need to go, but I just find it so interesting how that word came into play and how the Buddha then used that word to explain remembering, to remember. So to recap everything that we've talked about so far, to understand the roots and history of mindfulness and where it came from, to answer the question where it came from, we have to understand first that it comes from the Buddhist texts, the Buddhist philosophy, the oldest of which is the Pali Canon, which records the original teachings and dissertations of the Buddha. In the Pali Canon, the Buddha used the word Sati as to remember, and that's what Sati can be directly translated as, to remember. And modern scholars have interpreted this to include the entire concept of what the Buddha taught in addition to what the word meant, to come to a full understanding that mindfulness is a conscious and intentional awareness of the present moment and bringing your awareness away from distraction into the present moment to live in the present moment more fully. Furthermore, the Hindu mythology of Shiva and Sati adds a little more depth and understanding to why the Buddha used that word in particular at the time and how that word came to mean to remember. I know that for me, understanding this history and understanding the true nature of where mindfulness came from and the context that surrounds it, it's really helped me deepen my practice. It's really helped me find the sense of mindfulness that the Buddha taught about. It's helped me understand more clearly what it is that I need to focus on, to understand that I need to remember that clinging to sensations, to different distractions and things like that, only sets me up for failure and only encourages a negative spiral into just negativity in general. I hope that this for you has also helped you learn a little bit more of the depth behind mindfulness and has hopefully cleared up your practice a little bit and helped you find just a little more clarity in what it is that you do when you perform mindfulness practices. Understanding this history is so important to ensuring that you know what it is that you're supposed to be practicing and the tenets, the foundational texts, the foundational principles that underlie mindfulness. Well, that just about wraps it up. So if you guys enjoyed today's episode, make sure to let me know by liking it or subscribing to the podcast. If you have any comments, questions, or clarifications for me, I'd love to hear them in the comments. Otherwise, you can find Meditative Aiden on YouTube. You can also check out meditativeaiden.com for the full blog article on this. And don't forget that you can follow and like Meditative Aiden on Instagram and Facebook for additional daily information and advice. Again, thanks for tuning in. I hope you guys enjoyed today's episode, and I'll see you next week.